This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll talk about the life and legacy of John Conyers. The Detroiter and former dean of the U.S. House of Representatives is dead at 90. We'll look at his long career in Congress and his work on civil rights. Then, the winners and losers of the UAW-GM deal.
Strikes are painful, and some people say both sides lost because, you know, GM lost like $2 billion from having, you know, shut down production for all these weeks. And a lot of workers lost thousands of dollars worth of wages.
And Rachel Denhollander talks about her new book, What is a Girl Worth?
So that people understand and they hear the voices of other survivors coming out and they can look at my story and they can say, if it was that difficult for a white middle-class woman who's an educated attorney, imagine how much more so it is for a survivor from a minority or an impoverished community.
Those stories today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. She was one of the key voices at the center of the Larry Nassar scandal, leading a group of sister survivors through the trial and through the trauma of confronting their abuser. Later in the program, we talked to Rachel Denhollander about her new book, What is a Girl Worth? But first, the former dean of the U.S. House of Representatives, John Conyers, died yesterday. He was 90. The congressman was known for his staunch representation of his Detroit-based district and for withering lines of questioning during committee hearings. He also was known for his work on civil rights. Here is Conyers in a series called His Dream, Our Stories, about advocating for Martin Luther King Jr. to receive a holiday to honor his memory.
I can remember some people said, well, yeah, well, he was very good, but you can't get a holiday for Dr. King. There were too many people that didn't agree with his ideas of equality and fairness and democracy when it came to people of all colors. And it took a long while before that became a reality.
And Conyers was also known for introducing legislation to look at reparations for descendants of enslaved African Americans. He introduced H.R. 40 at the beginning of every term.
Out of that introduction of legislation, a whole new interest in the subject, I'm happy to say, it was developed, and many people are working on it.
In recent years, Conyers' reputation was tarnished amidst allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct. Conyers resigned under pressure over the allegations in 2017. Here he is on the Mildred Gaddis radio program in Detroit.
This too shall pass. And I want you to know that my legacy will continue through my children.
The Detroit congressman's storied career spanned more than 50 years. Here to talk more about who John Conyers was and his legacy is Ken Coleman, author, journalist, and a Detroit Black history buff. Ken, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so let's start there at the end of Conyers' career and, of course, at the end of his life. What did those most recent months look like for him, and how did he work to regain whatever he had lost by resigning his post?
Well, they were tragic, a tragic set of months, to be sure, not only for Conyers, but for tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of constituents in his Northwest Detroit, and it expanded out outside the city in the last several terms. But lots of Metro Detroiters who remembered a much happier and spirited time in John Conyers' tenure as a U.S. House member. You know, as we write political obituaries and biographies are written about great political leaders, it's always complicated, right? In almost every case, Conyers, for more than 50 years, was clearly a stalwart for the civil rights and human rights communities, not only in Michigan, as a U.S. House member representing the state, but throughout the country. A lot of us grew up sort of recognizing that John Conyers was just not our U.S. House member in Detroit, but he really was sort of a national House member, sometimes criticized for missing votes on Capitol Hill because he would go to another part of the country to represent a group of oppressed people who shared the values that he shared. It is very, very much John Conyers' legacy is a complicated mosaic, but a very inspirational and aspirational mosaic.
Well, so who was John Conyers before he ran for office, and how did he decide to go into politics?
It's a great question. John Conyers, like tens of thousands of Detroit families, moved to the Motor City from the South. His family came here from Georgia during the Great Migration period in the 1920s. John Conyers was born in Detroit in 1929, right on the cusp of the Great Depression, and then ultimately his formative years through the Second World War. He and his family grew up in Northwest Detroit in a community that we call the Old West Side. It was a tight-knit, upwardly mobile, middle-class Black community that included family names that we all know today, Gordys. Gordy, as in the legendary Motown family, but also Judge Damon Keith, who was several years older, but grew up in that neighborhood. Conyers graduated high school from Northwestern High in Detroit and went on to earn a law degree at Wayne State University.
So when he goes to Congress, what does Congress look like, especially for a Black politician in 1965 when he takes office?
It's Lily White. White, to be sure. He's sworn in January of 1965. But the great news in terms of diversity, the great news about Conyers is he has a sort of political big brother and U.S. House member Charles Diggs Jr., who also represents a portion of Detroit and was elected in 1954. And Diggs and Conyers go on to not only represent Detroit, but represent really swaths of the country that where African-Americans and other oppressed people live, but don't necessarily have a person of color to represent them in terms of votes on Capitol Hill. Here's a great trivia question that a lot of people don't really know, or a trivia fact. John Conyers almost didn't make it to the U.S. House of Representatives. Hmm. On September 1st, 1964, he bested in a Democratic primary race, he bested Richard H. Austin. Austin went on to become our Michigan Secretary of State, but Conyers beat Austin by a mere 108 votes on that September 1st primary. And it also went to a recall. And after the recall, Conyers won by only 43 votes. And so the man who became the longest serving African American in the U.S. House of Representatives almost didn't get there.
Almost never was. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, in later years, he was seen as a statesman who understood and played Washington politics well. He had bipartisan collegial relationships. His replacement, Rashida Tlaib, has been seen as a pot stirrer so far, and is happy, I think, in that position to be doing so. Did Conyers ever carry that reputation?
I think he did, and I'll go one step further. I mean, and you know, Laura, you certainly understood that race to replace him. Many candidates in that primary, several African Americans, and Rashida Tlaib ended up being the Democratic nominee. I'll go as far as to say, out of all of those men and women, some of whom are African American, who vied for that primary seat to replace John Conyers, Tlaib really does represent the best embodiment of who John Conyers was from a political standpoint. His voting record, the initiatives that which he had interest. Rashida Tlaib, I think, embodies that best in terms of being John Conyers-like.
Ken Coleman, author and a reporter with MichiganAdvance.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We get a lot of messages about who we should be from other people. What happens when we decide to write our own narratives instead? That's the topic of this week's episode of Same, Same, Different, Michigan Radio's podcast about identity and difference. Marenike Jiwa Onaiwu is a guest on the latest episode. She's a writer, advocate, and researcher who identifies as autistic. Host Bryce Huffman spoke with Onaiwu about how she came to understand her identity on her own terms.
When I graduated high school, I decided I'm going to use my name because all through school, teachers, you know, I was raised in the Midwest and then later moved to Texas. Teachers just always gave me some kind of a nickname because they said my name was too hard. And so I decided, yeah, they were like, I'm not going to say that. I'm thinking, but you can say these complicated, you know, Eastern European names or whatever that people have, but there's no effort to say mine. And so when I graduated high school, I decided I'm going to use my name and people are going to call me by my name, not by a nickname to hide who I am. Yeah. And so in terms of my identity, I started thinking about my kids. I didn't want them. Everything I read about autism was so depressing. Autism sufferers. Yeah, I may have autism, but autism may not, doesn't have me. And, you know, he's locked away inside and, you know, hurry up early, hit hard, hit early, early intervention so that you can change their life. They'll almost seem indistinguishable from the norm. I was like, goodness gracious. You know what I mean? Like, how am I supposed to raise a child that's to be proud of who they are when they think that everything about them is so horrible, you know? And so I wanted to find ways to instill pride in them and trying to find positive alternatives to see who they were. And then when I discovered myself, I was thinking it was even more so important for them and for me to realize this is me. This is Marina Kay. I don't have to speak the way that other people speak. I don't have to move the way that other people move. I don't have to suppress myself and be in emotional and physical pain so that I can hide who I am. If they don't like it, screw it. I'm going to be me. And I started to also use the term, you know, kind of like Ernesto mentioned, you know, stating, you know, I'm Chicano. You know, I openly identify as autistic, not because it, you know, people have to do that. Everyone's diagnosis is their business, but because I need to be a visible demonstration. Like, I try to own it and no longer hide. I've flipped it. It's kind of like how people took black, you know, James Brown, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. It's about people taking their power and owning themselves.
You can hear this week's full episode of Same Same Different and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you listen. Coming up, the UAW and GM ratified a new contract on Friday after 40 days on strike.
You know, it shows that the union can really succeed. And I think this will embolden the union to hang tough in negotiations with Fiat Chrysler and with Ford.
We'll look at the larger implications for the labor movement next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. After 40 days on strike, the UAW and GM ratified a new contract on Friday. The agreement includes pay raises for workers, the end of the two-tier system, and the shuttering of three plants. Here to talk about what the strike means for the labor movement is Stephen Greenhouse, a former New York Times labor reporter and author of a new book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
All right, so give me your big takeaways from this strike.
So I think the strike was a draw in many ways. You know, clearly the union was very angry that GM had closed the Lordstown plant and really wanted the plant reopened. And at the same time, the union felt that, you know, they helped pull General Motors out of bankruptcy back in 2009. They gave all sorts of concessions. Pay freezes, a two-tier wage system, and they wanted, I guess their message was, we helped you, GM, and you haven't done enough to repay us, and we want to recoup some of the pay we lost. We want to end the two-tier wage system. So when I say it was a draw, they made some big gains on pay, on compensation, but they failed at their big goal of getting General Motors to agree to reopen the Lordstown plant.
Was the Lordstown plant the big aim? I know they are going to repurpose or keep open anyway the Hamtramck plant, which is a big deal here. But was Lordstown really the big one they were shooting for?
I'd say yes. You know, Lordstown was a you know, just a huge plant, you know, and symbolically very important. President Trump went to the Youngstown, Lordstown area a few years ago and said, don't worry, you don't have to sell your homes. This plant is going to remain open. Historically, in UAW history, this has been a major, major plant, the scene of tremendous labor disputes about trying to make work more humane. And just symbolically, it was really important for the UAW. And I think keeping that plant open was one of the main goals in the talks, and GM was extremely intransigent on it. And I think, you know, partly to buy off the union and its members, GM agreed to a richer pay package, compensation package, than it would have. And to me, it was, you know, extremely unusual for a company to offer an $11,000 signing bonus. That's a whole lot of money. It's like, we're going to pay you off because we know and you know that certain other parts of the contract of the agreement are not very good.
So because Lordstown has been at the middle of a political circus, if you will, and been made an example of by President Trump, what does this portend? What does this strike portend for the future of our political election cycle here coming up in the next year?
I'm sure the Democrats will seize on the closing of Lordstown to say, Donald Trump, you promised that no plants would close on your watch as president. Donald Trump, you told the people of Lordstown, Youngstown area, you told the people of Ohio, don't worry, no need to move. I'll manage to keep the plant open. So I think the Democrats and labor unions, you know, will use this as a club to bang Donald Trump over the head with. And I think also a lot of workers will feel, you know, Donald Trump promised to bring back all the jobs. He promised to stop jobs moving to Mexico. Yet this big plant closed down largely because General Motors had moved the operation of what was made in Lordstown to Mexico. To be a little more specific, GM said we need to close the Lordstown plant because sales of our Chevy Cruze had fallen. And that's true. The sales had fallen. So it closed the plant here while one of its plants in Mexico continues to make Chevy Cruzes. So it's a real black eye, so to speak, for GM and I think for Donald Trump as well.
It's interesting, though, as we look at this current strike, even though these plants and the union has come into focus in our political spectrum, it also seems like outside of local media or at least in the Midwest, it doesn't seem like the strike had received quite as much coverage as other issues seem to take over the news cycle, both on television and in newspapers. Did you get a sense that this wasn't necessarily receiving the same coverage it may have pre-recession, pre-auto bailout?
Yes and no. I mean, on a certain level, Laura, it's impeachment all the time right now.
Right.
So considering that, I think the strike got a lot of coverage. I mean, I was just reading this fabulous piece in the Boston Globe that must be a 3,000-word piece about, you know, the closing of Lordstown and what that means for Ohio and for the nation and symbolically. And, you know, this, you know, and the strike was the lead story in the New York Times, where I worked for 31 years, you know, the lead story for the New York Times the day the strike began. I thought it got a lot of coverage. You know, a lot of labor things haven't gotten much coverage in recent years and recent decades. And I think, you know, GM is an iconic company. Lordstown is a very important plant. You know, there's been a wave of strikes in the past 18 months with the teacher strikes and the Marriott strikes and the Stop and Shop strike in New England. And I think this kind of got a lot of attention because it was GM and because, you know, it was the biggest private sector strike in over a decade. And also it's kind of this growing wave of strikes and people are, newspapers, the media paying more attention to what labor is doing when it goes on strike.
What does the outcome of this strike tell you about overall union might?
So, you know, in my book, I have beaten down, worked up the past, present, and future of American labor. I write a lot about General Motors and its kind of iconic clashes, confrontations with the United Auto Workers, the Flint sit-down strike, which was a pivotal strike in finally enabling organized labor to unionize the nation's largest company. I think here, a lot of companies are going to look at this settlement, a lot of unions are going to look at this settlement and say, General Motors is moving definitively away from a two-tier contract system to help pull itself out of bankruptcy back in 2009 and insisted that the UAW accept, you know, reluctantly accept this two-tier wage system where longtime workers are making $29 an hour, but new hires would make between like 14 and 24 an hour. And the new hires really resented that. They really got angry that they were working alongside, you know, people who were making 29 an hour when they were only making 14 and 17 and 24 an hour. So in this agreement, General Motors agreed definitively to like close down the whole idea of two-tier wage system. And I think that's going to have ripple effects across America where other unions are going to say, well, GM ended two-tier contracts. We should too. And GM also agreed to phase out, to stop using temporary workers, which is another sore point in the negotiations. One thing that was very interesting for me is the day the strike began, Terry Dittus, who was the UAW's chief negotiator with General Motors, said, "We are not striking just for us, we're striking for all Americans. You folks don't like factories moving to Mexico, we're going to fight against that. You folks, you know, are worried about the future jobs for your children, your grandchildren, our grandchildren." And they said, "General Motors, this great company, 7% of its workers are temporary workers making just $15 an hour. We're going to fight that, not just to help current auto workers, but to help the nation, because we have to phase out these precarious, unsteady, uncertain jobs that just pay $15 an hour."
So you mentioned what this might mean for the near term. What does it mean for the long term for the UAW and unions?
So, it's hard to look in one's crystal ball and say what it means long term. I think it certainly means, the UAW did not lose this strike. I think, at worst, it was a draw. And in many ways, it was a victory, except for Lordstown, because on the compensation front, it won a lot. It got pretty good raises. It got a phasing out of the two-tier wage system. It got a phasing out of GM's using temps. And GM was demanding that the union pay a lot more towards health coverage. The workers now just pay 3% of overall health coverage, and the company wanted them to pay 10%. The company gave up on that demand, and the workers are still paying just 3%. So I think it means, it shows that the union can really succeed. And I think this will embolden the union to hang tough in negotiations with Fiat Chrysler and with Ford. And I think other unions looking at this will say this continues the winning streak, even though I'm not sure if this was a win. But, they'll say this shows that when unions go on strike and hang tough and take to the streets and are fairly militant, workers can gain more than they would if they don't. Having said that, strikes are painful. And some people say both sides lost because, GM lost like $2 billion from having, shut down production for all these weeks. And a lot of workers lost thousands of dollars worth of wages. But on the other hand, the workers will say, "We made these important gains and it was worth it."
Stephen Greenhouse is a former New York Times labor reporter and the author of the recently released book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Rachel Denhollander became well known in recent years as the leader of a group of sister survivors, the many women and girls who were sexually abused by sports doctor Larry Nassar.
Rachel Denhollander,
R-A-C-H-A-E-L. Denhollander was the first person to tell her story on the record about the abuse she suffered and the institutions where Nassar worked, including USA Gymnastics and Michigan State University. During her victim impact statement at Nassar's sentencing, she spoke about the result of a culture that protects abusers.
"This is what it looks like. It looks like a courtroom full of survivors who carry deep wounds. Women and girls who have banded together to fight for themselves because no one else would do it."
Denhollander has a new memoir out, What is a Girl Worth? My story of breaking the silence and exposing the truth about Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics. And she joins us now. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before we dive into the book, I want to talk a little bit about what's going on right now. A couple of weeks ago, a group of sister survivors met with the new president of Michigan State University, Samuel Stanley, and they say that they left disappointed. One parent even said that it was more of the same from MSU. Where do things stand from your perspective with Michigan State and the sister survivors?
I would echo that deep disappointment. MSU has yet to publicly identify a single failure that was made. They have yet to point to one time an employee didn't report Larry and say, "This is not okay." We have been asking for 3 years for a comprehensive review of what happened, one that is able to obtain all of the facts and put out a public report. And that has yet to be done. We've had reviews done in specific departments that were forced by the Department of Education and other enforcement. But we've never had a comprehensive review done. And I actually spent the last 8 months, three of my sister survivors and I spent the last 8 months working with the board. And we had put together exactly what MSU needed and what we've been asking for the last 3 years. And then we had four board members stall it. And unfortunately, President Stanley wouldn't step in to say anything.
Have you spoken with him before, now that he's in this new role? Have you met with him or spoken with him?
I have not. I was not able to meet to make any of those meetings. Of course, I'm out of state, and I'm more than happy to. I would love the opportunity to sit down, but that has not happened. The offer has not been made.
How do you make heads or tails of this? What do you ascribe to how the university has been interacting with the whole group of survivors from the very beginning till now?
You know, it started off with a very antagonistic tone, a tone of more concern for liability, more concern for their reputation than there was for the safety of little girls and the safety of students. And I think it's important to note that, you know, as we have been saying for the last 3 years, this is not a Larry Nassar problem. This is a cultural problem. This is a problem at MSU. You know, we have multiple instances where the Title IX office or employees at MSU fail to report abuse. But there are breakdowns in the Title IX process and on MSU's campus all the time. And what are we going to do about those survivors whose voices aren't heard? You know, who don't have the media pressure, who can, you know, extract all this information with FOIA reports, because there are hundreds of survivors on MSU's campus who are still not seen and who are still not heard. And that's the entire point of the advocacy we've been doing over the last 3 years is, look, you need to root out these problems because you're leaving all of your students at risk. You're leaving everyone on your campus at risk if you haven't identified exactly what went wrong. And MSU has refused to do that. They have still refused to waive attorney-client privilege, even for law enforcement investigations. So they are withholding thousands of documents from the Attorney General as she is trying to investigate what went wrong from a legal standpoint at MSU. They're refusing to turn over that information. When the Attorney General's investigation started, they sent a deluge of useless information, like the bed bug policy in dorm rooms, and coupons, and you know, all kinds of extraneous information to bury what they did turn over. So it's been a complete culture of noncompliance and silencing survivors and refusing to admit what went wrong right from day one.
What would you say is the culture that is preventing things from moving forward in a way that identifies these issues and can root them out?
Yeah, you know, I think what we are really seeing here and what we see every time is we see the cultural problems that we have across the country in every sector blown up and put under a microscope. And so you really see two factors at MSU. You have a contingent that realizes they have a problem, but they're so afraid of liability and they value money so much that they are unwilling to do the right thing. They prioritize money over the safety of people. And then you have another contingent that has simply fallen prey to rape myths and abusive culture, and they really don't see the problem. They don't understand why it's such a big deal. And both facets are deeply troubling. Both facets leave everyone on campus unsafe. But those are not dynamics unique to MSU. You have those same dynamics playing out across the country in other universities, in athletic departments, in national governing bodies for Olympic associations, in religious institutions, and just in communities where abusers are allowed to flourish. There is a consistent pattern in this country of either looking at abuse and saying, not a big deal. Why does it matter? Why aren't you over it? Or a pattern of saying, well, that's bad, but money is worth more. Because ultimately, that's what we do. We pull out a scale. Every time we make a decision, we pull out a scale. And on one side, we put people. And on the other side, we put our competing interests, the money or the liability that we're afraid of. And we decide which one matters more. MSU is consistently deciding that money matters more. But that's not unique to MSU.
You worked with then-Senator Margaret O'Brien on a package of bills that would have and did change Michigan law around mm-hmm. sexual assault statute of limitations. Those bills were passed, but there was a series of bills that were included in that package that did not get a vote or did not make it all the way through the legislature. So at least a lot left to be desired, mm-hmm. including the ability to sue institutions like Michigan State. Tell me a little bit about how you felt about the outcome of those bills.
You know, the honest reality is the House of Representatives slapped us in the face. That's the truth. Because that package of bills, the 10 bills that I worked on with Senator O'Brien, that we had overwhelming bipartisan support for in the Senate, were designed to bring Michigan up out of being almost the worst in the country on many provisions of sexual assault justice, really to just kind of in the middle. You know, we were not proposing something that was radical by any stretch of the imagination. But the main provisions of that package really were gutted by the House of Representatives. And they did exactly what we asked them not to do, which was to create a very narrowly tailored provision that applied only to Nassar survivors. And I sat in that House of Representatives and I begged them not to do it. And I said, this is not about us. This is about every survivor that you're not seeing, who doesn't have media pressure, who doesn't have a sisterhood, who's never going to see justice because you have closed off the doors of the courtroom to them with an archaic statute of limitations. Don't you dare make this about us. This is about everybody you're not seeing. And they did exactly what we asked them not to do.
So it sounds like you're not satisfied with the outcome of any of what was voted on, essentially.
The vast majority of it, no, because what we were going for really did get gutted. There are a few things that were done great. The other acts, there's a particular statutory provision for evidence law that was passed that was excellent. And I was very grateful to see that through because that had been stalled for about 3 years in committee. And we were able to get that through. But the vast majority of what needed to be done ultimately did not get done. And it did not get done because of caving to special interest groups.
We reached out to Michigan State University with an opportunity to respond to Ms. Denhollander's comments. We did not hear back. After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Rachel Denhollander. We'll talk about her relationship with her mother and whether or not she'd allow her children to join gymnastics. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. We continue now with my conversation with Rachel Denhollander. We recently spoke about her new book, What is a Girl Worth? Why did you want to write this book, Rachel?
Oh, so many reasons. The honest truth is I didn't really want to write it because it was a very difficult process, and having it out there is just one more level of exposure. So for a long time, I said, it's not happening. I'm not going to do that. But it got to the point where I looked at what had happened with the Nassar investigation and just the weight of realizing how many other survivors' voices are not heard and are never going to be heard because they don't have hundreds coming forward and they don't have media pressure and they don't have those dynamics that we had, but their cases are every bit as important. And so it got to the point where I said the difficulty of writing it is going to be outweighed by the benefit that I hope will come from it. Because really, most people turned in to the Nassar investigation all the way at the end when Larry was this gaunt figure in an orange jumpsuit sitting in a courtroom and he couldn't lift his eyes. But that's not who Larry had been a year earlier. And those are not the dynamics that we faced when we came forward. And what people don't understand is what it took to get to that place. Everything that we faced, that I faced, to wrest control from the organizations that were shielding Larry. The breakdowns, the multiple breakdowns with law enforcement that was shielding Larry or botching investigations, the authority figures, the culture, the community, and just what an incredible uphill battle it was to get to that moment and how unusual it is to get to that moment. And so the first thing I really wanted to do is lift the veil on all of that and to show what it really took so that people understand and they hear the voices of other survivors coming out and they can look at my story and they can say, if it was that difficult for a white middle-class woman who's an educated attorney, imagine how much more so it is for a survivor from a minority or an impoverished community, or who doesn't have family support, or who doesn't have a detective and a prosecutor who are passionate about the truth. Because we need people to speak for those survivors.
Rachel, I'm hoping that I can get you to read a passage for me from your book.
Sure.
This passage takes place. You've just finished watching the girls in 1996 in Atlanta just take the world by storm at the Olympics.
I can. The emotion of the moment was palpable. These little girls with perfect bodies had done what no other U.S. women's gymnastics team had ever done. They'd paid a high price, including the injury of a teammate, and still they had persisted. It was incredible. And it reminded me of how much I loved that sport. I'd taken a gymnastics class once when I was little, and I had been in awe of it ever since. I didn't remember much, except how bad the foam pit smelled and how much I'd wanted to continue but couldn't. It was just too expensive. I was 11 and a half now, years too late to be a serious gymnast, but I still wanted back in the gym. Everything about it amazed me. I loved the combination of mental and physical acuity the sport required, the level of perfection and amount of repetition needed to make every move flawless and beautiful. I marveled at the gymnasts' physical strength and flexibility, as well as their diligence and determination. I loved that you couldn't do this sport halfway or pick it up casually. I was a perfectionist, and I wanted a sport that demanded this from me.
So I love that passage, first of all, because I remember feeling very strongly in 1996 as well. And now you want back into the sport and you realize that the sport calls to you because of what it calls in your character. Well, you apply that standard to gymnastics, but you also write about it in similar terms when it comes to religion and repentance, mm-hmm. as well as justice within the law along similar lines. So how does this need for a structure that strives towards perfection work in your life?
You know, I think at the essence, that's something all of us feel. All of us know that there is right and wrong, that there are certain things that are absolutely inexcusable, that are not okay in any circumstance. Sexual abuse is one of them. Sexual abuse is never okay. And so all of us have this intrinsic desire and need for justice because we know that certain things are always wrong. And when you really look at what we are doing, every little decision that we make, you know, ultimately we are stripping it down to a decision of right and wrong, a decision of cost and benefit. And so that's something I try to do every time I am faced with a decision, is go, what am I really balancing here? You know, and strip it down to the essence of that decision.
Well, you spent some time talking about abuse of coaches in the world of gymnastics and the psychological toll it obviously takes on young girls. And not sexually abusive necessarily, but mm-hmm. emotionally, even physically in some ways. How did that experience within that world of gymnastics allow you to see abusive leadership in other areas of your life, like perhaps in the church or at Michigan State or even with Larry Nassar?
Yeah, it is a rampant problem in the world of gymnastics and in many, many athletic organizations. I was very fortunate that the gym I was at was not abusive. I had a very positive experience with all of my coaches. And that really provided me with an excellent contrast to those abusive coaching methods, to be able to look at it and say, you know what, you don't have to break little girls to raise champions. You don't have to prioritize money and medals over people. And to understand that the greatest motivator anyone has is to be motivated by love, to know that they are safe, to feel safe with their coaches, and to be motivated by love of the sport and joy of doing it with their teammates and with their coach. That's how you raise healthy athletes who pour themselves into the sport in a way that is constructive instead of destructive. And so I was very fortunate to have that contrast, but many athletes can't say that. Gymnastics is a very abusive sport, and you know it is not just the sexual abuse, though that is rampant in the organization, but it is, as you said, the physical and the verbal abuse and the emotional abuse, where you are taking little children who are dependent on their coaches and on their gym environment for safety. And those little girls know that they're dependent on their coach for safety. And they are just torn down at every chance they get. And ultimately, the reason for that is because we think it works.
Well, and in some ways it does work, right? I mean,
mm-hmm, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is an element to which you can make someone so afraid of messing up, so afraid of the fallout and the abuse that comes from messing up, so afraid of losing their identity and their value because you've tied up their identity and their value into their success, their athletic success, that they will work incredibly hard because they're dependent on it. But what that does is creates an extreme dysfunction in the individual. But a lot of leaders don't really care about that. Because again, they're pulling out that scale. And on one side, they're putting money and medals and the reputation of the organization. On the other side, they're putting little girls who pay the price. And they're deciding that money and medals matter more.
Rachel, you've used the term little girls several times in this conversation. You use it throughout the book as well. And, you know, I think I understand what you mean, but you're also using it sort of across the board, whether you're talking about a 6-year-old girl who's just starting gymnastics or a 20-year-old young woman who is in college. Why do you use that term across the board when you're talking about these affected women and girls?
Well, part of the reason is because for the most part, most of us were little girls when this happened. I was more on the upper age of the spectrum, being 15, and I was still a child. But most of us were little girls. And particularly when you're dealing with the world of gymnastics, you're dealing with little girls. And that's something that very easily gets lost because these athletes, when they become elite, they are the top. They are the best of the best athletes in the world. And it's easy to lose sight of the fact that they are children and we are doing this to children. And I think that's something USAG needs to be more honest about, even to themselves. You know, several Olympic athletes have come out talking about how much they were starved at the Curly Ranch, how their gym bags would be searched for food and they were deprived of food to the point that sometimes they would have to go around in hotels and they would have to look for leftover room service that had been put out in the hallway because they were literally starving. Yeah, and we need to realize those were little girls. You know, when you've got little girls going to the Coralie Ranch, some of those kids were as young as 9 and 10 years old.
Right.
You're searching a 10-year-old's gym bag to make sure she doesn't have a granola bar. You're starving a child. And we need to put it in those terms. We need to stop letting these athletic organizations hide behind the mature athletic ability that these kids have. And we need to look at what they're really doing. No, you're starving a child. You're abusing a child. And abuse is horrific in any form. And so I don't mean that to mitigate abuse of older women, because it is evil in any form. But we need to be honest about what's really going on. And we need to not allow organizations to reframe the issue by doing things to make it look like it's more acceptable, or like there is, like these children have more ability to defend themselves than they do. They're children.
Well, it's sort of almost like an out-of-body experience, I want to say. I would imagine that looking at a situation that happened to you as a girl, now as a woman, and a mother, and a daughter, and all of those things, it would probably, on one hand, make you feel like you still were that little girl, you still are that little girl that this happened to, but also that I would be infuriated for that little girl, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's a very accurate way of saying it. And that's something that I really always see in front of me. You know, again, with the Nassar sentencing hearing, most people saw women standing up because most of us, not all of us, but most of us were grown, you know, and had become women. But we were all little girls, and many of them were very, very young. And that's what I see in front of me all the time. You know, I see the incredibly powerful women that they have become, but I see the little girls that they were when they were left defenseless and they were left at the mercy of a predator because the adults didn't want to do the right thing.
I'm speaking now with Rachel Den Hollander. She wrote a book, What is a Girl Worth? My Story of Breaking the Silence and Exposing the Truth About Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics. I want to talk about the relationship with your mother. You write a lot about the relationship with your mom. You clearly have a deep, abiding love and respect for her. Mm-hmm. And for the guidance she provided you as you were growing up. But now that you're a mother as well, how has it affected the parenting and guidance that you received from your mom as you navigated that crisis with Larry? How do you think about it in terms now as a mom, as yourself?
Honestly, it has made me realize all the more how incredibly unusual my parents were and how difficult it was and would have been to go through what they went through. Because being a mom now, I understand so much better even the depth of love that a good parent has for their child and just that incredible desire to keep them safe and to protect them mm-hmm. and the horrific reality that you can do everything right. And I really do believe my parents did. I look back on what they did and how they did it, and there's nothing I would have had them do differently. They were very open with communication. I knew my mom was a survivor. We talked about abuse. We talked about bodily autonomy, privacy, you know, we talked about all those things very openly. I never had any fear that I wouldn't be able to speak up and have my parents believe me. You know, and so I look back on that and there's nothing really that I would have had my parents do differently.
Right.
And that's difficult for me to wrestle with as a mm-hmm. mom is to realize you can do it all right and your kids can still end up very, very hurt. But it's also shown me the importance of being that safe place for your children to land. Because while my parents couldn't keep everything bad from happening to me, they gave me a safe place to heal. They gave me a safe place to speak up. And that is invaluable.
Well, with all that your mom had been through herself and being very conscious of wanting to protect you from abuse and still you ran into Larry, mm-hmm. how do you reconcile now protecting your own children with not keeping them in a bubble and making sure they still have a full life as you did?
Yeah, absolutely. I really go back to looking at a lot of what my parents did. They had a lot of very wise boundaries in place that did save me, I think, from further abuse and from abusive situations that I could have fallen into. For example, when I started gymnastics, and again, I talk about some of this in the book, but when I started gymnastics, my mom and I had a lot of conversations and continued to have conversations on what a healthy coaching style would look like, on boundaries for what a coach should or shouldn't do, including sexual boundaries. What sorts of things should a coach never ask you? What sorts of jokes should a coach never tell? You know, how do you pay attention to how you're being spotted to make sure a coach is not taking advantage of a situation? We talked about all of those things. And my mom told me when I started, if I ever see a hint of an unhealthy coaching environment, you will be out of there so fast, you're not going to know what pulled you. Hmm. You know, and she said, and I know that might be hard. I know you might get angry if I take that step, but it is worth risking your anger to keep you safe. You are worth more than what you might accomplish in that sport. And so we had those conversations over and over and over again. I knew that my identity wasn't the gym because my parents taught me that. I knew where my value came from because my parents taught me that. And I knew that I was worth more than athletic achievement and that I would be protected if anything happened, even protected from myself.
Would you ever recommend to your kids that they do gymnastics if they were interested in it? I mean, it seems like there is a lot of you enjoyed the gym that you went to. You described
that,
right? You described this gym that's next to a Claire's, which I just thought was great.
Yeah.
But because you know how it can look at the elite level and even at the amateur level, the abuse that can go on in any sport that's taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. What would you say to your kids if they wanted to do gymnastics?
You know, one of my daughters is actually asking. She's been begging for a year. And until USAG cleans up their act, I do not trust them with my child's safety. And I wish I could say differently. That being said, while there are certainly very distinct pitfalls within gymnastics, very distinct areas where the sport lends itself to predators, it can be done in a way that is just beautiful, that nurtures, that trains the character and the whole athlete in a way that benefits them for the rest of their lives, that teaches them, that uses sports to teach life lessons, that makes them a whole person and a better person. And that's what sports is supposed to be. And so I would love for my daughters and my son to be able to participate in that sport, if that's something that they desire, in a way that is healthy. That being said, right now, the organization is so full of corruption and just a complete refusal to see the problem and to do the right thing. I would never put my child under their authority right now and dependent on their safety. In my daughter's case, she's 5 years old and she wants to do the bars specifically. She loves that idea of flying around the bars and hanging upside down and flipping around. And there's nothing much comparable to that. So I would love for my kids to be able to participate in a healthy way in that sport. And I would love for USAG to do the right thing so that the children participating in that sport can know that they're safe and that they can progress through the ranks in a way that is healthy, where they're going to be protected and valued. But we're not there yet.
Well, Rachel, I want to end here. In your book, you're talking about what's going through your mind as you're reading your victim impact statement, and you sort of break it up into the different parts, distill it down to the different parts. Mm-hmm. But you say, as I began, the words of the abolitionist William Wilberforce ran through my mind, quote, "You may choose to look the other way, but you can never again say you did not know." So I'm curious what it is that you can never again say that you did not know.
You know, the honest truth is from the last 3 years, I haven't had any surprises. And I almost wish I could say that I have. Because, you know, for 16 years, I said, I can't do this without media pressure. I can't do this anonymously. There are people shielding this abuser. I cannot trust anybody. Somebody's going to have to take control from these organizations. And I wish I had been wrong. I wish I had been able to come forward and be immediately met with, what went wrong? How can we fix it? We're so sorry. We're going to do the right thing. But I wasn't. And I was right about the depth of the damage. I knew that there would be little girls walking into Larry's door who were not going to be safe, and that there was nothing I could do to stop it unless I had the ability to take control from those organizations, unless I had media pressure. And I wish I could look back and say I had been wrong, that something could have been done, that there weren't people shielding Larry, that the depth of the damage wasn't so great. But I was right. Every time I was right. And that's the lesson that we need to take from this so that we do it better the next time.
Rachel Denhollander, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having the conversation.
Tomorrow on Stateside, Kalamazoo recently declared a climate emergency. That's just the latest example of local communities stepping up to address the effects of climate change while national and international leadership waver on how to respond.
It's an unfair situation, but it's one as well that has led cities to think of, you know, other means in which they can continue to build their capacity to respond.
Cities on the front lines against climate change. That's tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks for listening.